every terrifying story about ICE hurting people, killing people in the streets, the stories about unfair things happening in courts of law, there are also stories of hope, of the system working as it should, of things going well that doesn't make the news.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. President Trump's aggressive immigration crackdown is intensifying. Immigration agents detained over 10,000 people just in the last week of June. This month, ICE agents killed two men in less than a week, including a young Colombian father in Maine who had legal status. Despite the Trump administration's insistence that it is only arresting the worst of the worst, most of the people arrested by ICE have no criminal convictions. Fear is now a constant in immigrant communities. Anxiety has been compounded by a Supreme Court decision last month ending temporary protected status, or TPS, that may remove legal protection for over a million immigrants who have fled war or environmental disasters in their home countries. I spoke about the impact of these latest developments with Jill Martin Diaz, an immigration attorney who is executive director of the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project, or VAP. Since becoming VAP's first paid staff member in January 2024, Martin Diaz now oversees a paid staff of 10, a network of 28 volunteer attorneys, and over two dozen volunteer interpreters, among others. Martin Diaz formerly taught immigration law at Vermont Law and Graduate School, directed its Center for Justice Reform Clinic, and practiced at Vermont Legal Aid. In 2023, Martin Diaz was named by the LGBTQ+ Bar Association as one of the 40 best LGBTQ+ lawyers under 40 and has received awards from the Vermont Bar Association and the ACLU of Vermont. I began by asking Jill Martin Diaz to talk about the state of the immigration crackdown in Vermont.
It's funny because when I think about what we at VAP are living every day as the state of the immigration crackdown, it looks and feels and smells very different to what makes the headlines, like a person being murdered on the street for existing by federal law enforcement agencies is like unfathomably egregious and terrifying. And I think that's the point, right? The shock and awe that the Trump administration is trying to perpetuate to scare us into fearing for our freedom and to stop us from exercising our free will. What we see here at VAP is this much more mundane and grinding. It's like watching a slow car crash. Every day, the immigration courts, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, USCIS, there are decisions being made every day about who had status or who had rights, who no longer has them, and what process was due. How are we going to make the immigration system fair? And those rights and those protections are being stripped away every day in mundane seeming memos and orders from courts. And we're just watching the system slip between our fingers as we're trying to support Vermonters to access their needs. And it's tough because not only are we as lawyers bound by confidentiality, those are not my stories to share without my client's consent. They're also difficult to talk about and make meaningful with lay folks who aren't nerdy about the law like I am.
Well, talk about the range of ways that immigrants in Vermont are under pressure right now that perhaps they weren't 2 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Well, just from the last few months, the deluge of law and policy changes have put Haitians in Vermont. There's a couple dozen Haitians who have been living in Vermont for years and years, sometimes decades, with temporary protected status, who own businesses, who went to college, who are very much like integrated in our community, who suddenly find themselves now without temporary protected status, vulnerable to being arrested by ICE and prosecuted for removal proceedings, and most acutely, unauthorized to work. And it was a sudden decision from the Supreme Court a few weeks ago. Well, tomorrow, the decision to end TPS that the Trump administration made a while back is now allowed to go into effect. And so tomorrow, you're all out of a job if you don't have other applications pending, other work permits. With regards to vulnerable non-citizen youth, there is a growing population of young people who can't reunite with one or both parents because of reasons relating to abuse or neglect. And the law creates a pathway for those kids to pursue permanent residence, green cards, and to be able to move forward with their lives with their new chosen family here in the community. And now those young people are no longer being protected from detention and being subject to deportation, even if they have approved special immigrant juvenile status. And we're just encountering people who not only like have won the immigration lottery with respect to having a viable claim for relief, having found access to a lawyer to help them access those claims, enjoy those claims, and nevertheless being subject to ICE detention and removal proceedings anyway. And it's a mix of things that are legal, procedures that are legal and procedures that are illegal, that are violating the law, but it's up to us to prove it. And so we're in this strange posture of, trying to help people understand what the trade-offs are, what the risk is. If we identify things we can do for them under the law to help them reach their goal, well, now there's absolutely zero trust in the system. And so how can we promise that a person is safe just because the law, some pieces of paper, they are? The person who was killed during an ICE encounter in Florida last week was running away from an ICE officer and died in a traffic accident. That person was here on a valid tourist visa. But it's so scary to come into contact with the feds nowadays. Try and convince someone with a visa that they're safe, right?
What is happening out of sight? Are their arrests and deportations occurring around Vermont that we're not even hearing about?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so since we stood up our statewide coordinated intake this calendar year, we've seen a very steady, sharp increase in new calls for help every month, which makes sense as people learn about the system, they use it. And we've seen a really steady stream of people being arrested in Vermont. They continue to be arrested either incident to some kind of criminal legal proceeding is what we hear. They might be arrested opportunistically after being profiled by Border Protection, who are driving around our border zone, protecting the homeland, as is their mandate. We continue to see about one a month GPS fail case where someone was trying to get to the Midwest and their GPS led them to Canada. And now they're detained. It's felt pretty steady, actually, the number of arrests per month. We're getting a few requests from local Vermonters per week. And then we're still continuing to visit Northwest State Correctional Facility twice a month at this stage to do outreach with prospective clients who were detained there. And the number of detainees, while the number changes every day, ICE bringing people in, taking people out, the number has stayed steady at, between 12 and 18 people for the last many weeks.
These are immigrants who are detained either in-state or are being transited through Vermont and being held in Vermont jails on immigration charges of some sort.
Exactly. Exactly. And then when those cases come in, it's really a race against time because the VAP attorneys, all of our colleagues, we already had a full schedule for ourselves today, but now there's a person in Vermont. And so when a person arrives and we receive a call for help, if there's a claim to be brought in federal district court, we have to get the case pending before a Vermont federal judge sooner than ICE can transfer the person out again into a more hostile jurisdiction.
When you and I have talked in the past, some of the most dramatic, things that stay in my mind are your attorneys, VAP attorneys, are going into prisons not knowing what they're going to find, and finding people there who don't know where they are or why they're there, just that they're sitting in a jail in what turns out to be Vermont. What are you finding now when you on these prison visits?
Honestly, what we're finding now, it's sad. So content note for your listeners. Oftentimes what we're finding now is a call, like being called to this moment is to redefine success. We have to really think about what does victory look like? What does service look like? We still encounter people who are scared and misinformed and disconnected from their families, their communities, their council. People who haven't heard from a family member yet on the phone, and people who are just trying to make sense of what their options are. Most people are really looking for guidance about how to minimize their time in custody. And as defenders of rights, we want to go in and help people understand all of their rights under the Constitution, under federal immigration law, and help them assert those rights, fight them to the bitter end. But that's not client-centered lawyering. Client-centered lawyering is about meeting someone where they are at, helping them to understand what their goals, what their options are, and what are the options that will help them best meet their goals. So for a lot of folks, minimizing time in custody, the option to minimize, to reach that goal is to request voluntary departure rather than fight for asylum, fight for bond. I would say for every 5 to 8 individuals we encounter in detention, there's one who decides, I'm going to stay in detention for an indefinite amount of time because I'm going to exhaust my asylum seeking rights. And it's not because there aren't valid asylum claims. Like, these are cases that I was winning my whole career under the law until now. But they're people who just procedurally are being like effectively disincentivized from trusting the system. And detention is just so horrible and scary that that's what it looks like. So a lot of our work now is helping people to verify, you know, that that's their goal, helping them think through how to get there, how to minimize harm for themselves, their families on their way out, helping to reunify families that are already separated across borders. That's a lot of the work right now.
Where are people being deported to, whether they're self-deported or deported by some sort of judicial entity? And what are you hearing about outcomes when they do go to some other place?
Yeah, we have seen the full spectrum in our caseload. So we've seen individuals who request to be removed to their country of origin, and that is where they are sent. We've seen individuals who are removed to third countries under an ACA, asylum cooperative agreement with other nations.
These are like being sent to Africa when they're not African, things like that.
That's right. I don't believe we've had anyone sent intercontinentally, but like in the Americas, we have had people who were removed to other countries that are not their own country of origin in the Americas. And we've also had some good news stories, right? So there was a person for whom we had litigated constitutional issues in the judicial court, and we kind of reached the end of the line with this person. And the last thing we could try and do for them was to request a removal to a third country where they have a family member, and I believe they had some claim to status, although it was tenuous there. And they were so frightful of being sent back to their country of origin. Their last prayer for relief was, ICE, please, can you send me to this other place? At least I have a person who can receive me and I won't be in danger the way I would be in country of origin. And ICE stipulated and said yes, and actually followed through with their word. And so the person was removed to a third place where they felt safer.
Are you hearing about deportations that, you know, that end badly for the people being deported?
I have not personally heard about there's definitely, we see those tragedies coming up nationally of people being removed to countries of persecution and then experiencing persecution. what we have heard of mostly is people who are removed to their country of origin. The hardship that they face starting over, the isolation, they have no resources, their resources are left behind in the US. And we have heard of several people who immediately fled their countries of origin and are now living undocumented in other contiguous countries because that is safer than remaining in the country of origin where they were removed to.
What are some impacts that employers in Vermont are experiencing? I'm thinking in particular of elder care facilities, which typically have staff consisting of lots of people, immigrants from various countries, who are doing the very difficult and very intimate work of elder care that local people don't want to do.
I mean, there's already a staffing shortage in some critical industries in our state, and this the deportation campaign is exacerbating it, right? In ways that are kind of self-fulfilling and also external. So there's people who are losing their status, their right to work, and can't pivot to other statuses quickly enough. Employers are now in the difficult position of deciding whether to try to do a proactive I-9 verification process, or whether they want to hold the government to their burden and wait to be, wait until I-9 checks are due. How preemptively compliant are employers going to be? What is it going to mean for their businesses, for the services they provide, the goods they produce? Many of our key industries rely on migrant labor. And then at the same time, we also see some employers who are afraid, they're so afraid of liability and exposure that they might feel inclined to preemptively dismiss immigrant employees wholesale. That is illegal under the Vermont Fair Housing and Public Accommodations Act. And that does expose someone to liability, treating employees differently because of their national origin. But even a good faith actor could find themselves in hot water in this situation. And I really do think that's the point. The point is to make it very impossible to sustain oneself so that you are inclined to self-deport. And when you cut off someone's access to resources, that's when they retreat. Mostly, though, the questions we've been getting from employers or business associations that represent them are just like, how can we help? And the Trump administration has simultaneously made it exorbitantly expensive to petition on behalf of employees for employment-based immigration. That is still an option available to employers and something I encourage employers to look into, reaching out to the private immigration bar. But
Say
there's just a
more about
tragic.
that. What does that mean to advocate for employers to advocate?
So the immigration legal system offers pathways to status, pathways to rights like the right to work, to live permanently, to be free from detention, deportation, based on three categories. Your family-based pathways, your employment-based pathways, or your humanitarian-based pathways. We nonprofit lawyers tend to focus on humanitarian because they're complicated and they take a lot of hours and they're not cost-effective for a private attorney to do and turn a sustainable profit. But the private immigration bar handles the employment work. So when an elder care facility, like you mentioned, is short-staffed, they can't find their employees, prospective employees locally. And so they do an international search, and then they're allowed to petition the government for a visa for this prospective employee, saying, we have a need, we need to fill it with an immigrant worker, we need this person to come. And there's employment-based pathways to immigration status as well. And a lot of there's cool, exciting stuff happening with a lot of Vermont's mission-based businesses. The challenge is that the Trump administration raised all the filing fees for every type of petition, but including employment ones, to disincentivize employment-based petitioning.
What have the fees gone from what to what?
I believe that at the last count, the Category H non-immigrant visas that are often bridging a graduate from higher ed institution on a student visa into their adult working life, that the fee was in the 10,000, you know, 10,000, something like this. And then last year it was raised to 100,000 for many types of H category visas. So it's a tenfold increase. And we see that across the board in all areas of practice. Just the fees are like absolutely unattainable.
We are also hearing about pressure being put on international students, that their visas will not, they're not guaranteed, you know, legal status for the duration of their education. What do you know? What's happening here in Vermont with that?
I've been watching that very closely. Because as someone who found my critical thinking, my political education in university, I think about the ways in which the immigration system can be used to achieve all of these other authoritarian goals. As you mentioned, now the administration is trying to crack down on higher education. We know that international tuition paying students are the backbone of what makes higher education run. And we see now that students are going to have to exit the country potentially when the semester is not in session. Like, they're not going to be given bridging visas to be able to like live and just be here for the duration of their studies, let alone for optional practical training after their studies, if their visa allows for it, of getting a first job after college. That's what that means. And I'm wondering, like, really thinking big picture, like, interesting, now we're going to cut off like the backbone of our country's critical thinking machine. Oh, okay. And so it's about immigration, totally. And we as a state, we have a huge population here, considering how we are, like, a big proportion of students who are international. And I hope that we all continue to be really proactive about supporting our international students. It's not just about planning for graduation now. It's about sustaining oneself every step of the way. But then big picture, I'm thinking, okay, like, how can we make a ruckus about this? How can we raise up our voices and stay loud to protect the things that keep us free, like free speech and education?
Well, it strikes me as an incredibly kind of an own goal, since we're still in the World Cup jargon. It's, you know, foreign students attending U.S. colleges is a $1 billion a year industry. The U.S. is sort of the gold standard. It's the degree that many foreign students want. And now I'm reading numerous articles about how foreign students no longer feel safe in coming here. And it should surprise no one that the number one beneficiary of where these students now go is China, who are rolling out the welcome mat. And they have top universities, English language universities. They see the opportunity. And, you know, it's becoming a very common story that wherever the U.S. pulls back, China in particular moves in. They're very strategic, and they've been doing quite well in these things. And honestly, if I'm a foreign student or the parent of a foreign student, do I really want to put my kid on a plane and hope that they don't end up in ICE detention?
Right. I mean, to put a point on it, like, simultaneous to the client-centered lawyering we're doing with folks who are very imminently facing this requirement to be deported, I also, in my queer and trans community, hear all of the time, it feels like every week, I hear about someone in my network who's going to a going away party for someone who's moving out of the country because it's just too scary to exist while trans here. And so we laugh as asylum lawyers, like, remember, the legal standard is not the U.S. is a safer place to be trans than country of origin. It's just the country of origin is unsafe. And now I'm in the U.S. and now I want asylum here.
Say a little bit more about that, Jill, because I recently was at a gathering with two trans folks who were passing through Vermont on their way to Canada, where they are trying to get Canadian citizenship because they no longer feel safe here as trans people. Just, I wonder if you could comment, not just as a lawyer, but personally, about what you're seeing, hearing, and feeling about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something that's very personal to me. I don't know all your listeners. I am a non-binary trans person. If the conversations kind of feel similar to the ones that I'm having with my non-citizen clients about weighing their options, weighing the trade-offs of trying this, staying put, staying under the radar, taking control back in your own hands and leaving the country, it's similar calculus. And really what it comes down to is, I mean, relative privilege, like relational privilege, plays a lot of a role, right, in how a person can access resources and take care of themselves in this environment. And then it's a question of individual risk tolerance. You know, what is it that helps you to feel some sort of grounding in your day-to-day life, knowing that there is these, all of these unknowns, these existential threats, like it's scary. And in my community, there's people like me who so far I'm like, I haven't felt like I need to flee. The thing that's weird is I can see it happening though. When I think about my grandparents coming from Cuba to the US, I'm like, right, this is the first time in my life where I'm like, I guess like, yeah, I could see that happening, needing to flee. And then where would I go and what would starting over look like? It's humbling for those of us who come to immigration work from an allied perspective. Like, I've never experienced not being a US citizen. It's humbling to kind of put a point on it. And on the other hand, I think, you know what, similarly, it really shouldn't be up to the people most acutely attacked by the Trump administration to stand back and hold the line on constitutional and civil rights for all. Every time you do hear about a story of a trans person taking the government to court or an immigrant taking the government to court, remember that that is work, that's labor, it's traumatizing, it's exhausting, it's risky, and it's for the common benefit. Like, that every time a judge tells ICE to knock it off, what the judge is saying is, no, we are still a country of rule of law, and it's a gift. So when I think about it that way, I personally, that's like what refills my cup and makes me feel like I know what I'm supposed to do in this moment. And I'm like sitting in my apartment in the old North End of Burlington, and I'm probably going to go to a nice restaurant this weekend. Like, my life is very blessed. I'm very privileged. I know not everyone's in that position.
Tell us a little bit about your story. What brought you to Vermont and to practice immigration law, you know, in the world of law? There's ways to make money fast and ways to make money not at all. You seem to have chosen the latter, and why?
Oh man, how much time have you got? Well, it's a 30-minute program, so I think when I look back on my life, I think I came to Vermont to be trans. Like, honestly, when I look back at it, I'm like, oh, I'm like living with my little gay wife in little gay Burlington, and I'm doing my social justice lawyering work, and like, it's everything I ever wanted. And growing up in South Florida, it's everything I understood was not right.
A few of those, you've skipped over a lot of big things there. So you're the child of Cuban immigrants, grew up in South Florida. How did you even hear or know of Vermont as a place where you could live and be?
Yeah, so cousins of mine, so I grew up in a Cuban immigrant family. So we're all, you know, my aunts and uncles are my parents, my cousins are my siblings. And some of my cousins married into a family that were Camp Key Wayden, their Camp Key Wayden family. And so my aunt had come up to visit the boys at Lake Dunmore over the years and was always saying, you know, you guys don't know about Vermont. There's this magical place called Vermont. And one day I'm going to live there. And in South Florida, when everyone lost everything under the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008, my aunt applied for a job in Vermont on a lark and got it. And so now we just all randomly, we started visiting here and we loved it. I mean, that's the shortest story. The truest story is that my first day in Vermont was actually the day of my father's funeral. We had gone to Long Island and to bury him in this Jewish cemetery where my family has plots. And we were going to stay in the hotel that night, but my aunt was like, you guys got to come back with me to Vermont. I promise you're going to feel better waking up tomorrow in Vermont than you will here in Long Island. And that we drove all night, like got into bed and I woke up and I remember that day. Today was mid-September, the bluest skies, the greenest grass, the most stunningly beautiful place ever in Addison County. And I was there for 4 weeks on bereavement leave, and Vermont's where I came to heal. Hmm. I always knew I wanted to live here.
So you are part Cuban and part Jewish, or Cuban Jewish? Yeah. Explain that.
Yeah. So my family, my bigger family immigrated everywhere. So we're from the Canary Islands. Some people went back to Spain. Some people went to Miami and some people went to Brooklyn. And my mom and her sisters all grew up in the Jewish part of Brooklyn. And so they all married Jewish guys. And then, so half my cousins were raised Jewish and half of us were raised Catholic, but because we're all family, we just grew up celebrating every single holiday. So it was very fun in our family growing up. And we were like each other's social circle. And so we had just like a mix of everything, and we moved as a block to South Florida and then unsurprisingly moved as a block up here to Vermont.
Hmm. And were you always an immigration lawyer, or were you doing other types of law previously?
Once I got to law school, I decided pretty quickly that immigration was it for me. I had had a lot of immigration experiences of my own. I had permanent residency in other countries. I had worked in other countries. I had done international development work after college. I decided that I was feeling a little bit too feudal, a little bit too much like a one percenter ambassador of capitalism living in the international development world. And that's actually why I was in Timor-Leste in Dili, where Amy was. When I came to law school, I knew I wanted to trade to, I wanted something more concrete and helpful to offer the world if I was going to take up space in it. And I was interested in immigration because of my family history, my own experiences. And once I tried it, I got the bug. And so I started law school in 2013 and I've just been doing immigration the whole time.
Well, this gets to the story of the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project. There was barely an immigration bar in Vermont. And talk about where it began and where we are now with having trained immigration attorneys being able to represent people in Vermont.
Yeah, I actually can answer this question from a slightly less biased place, because this spring, colleagues and I have worked up a white paper that we're going to be publishing, documenting the how did we get here of the Vermont immigration system. And it's really fascinating to look at the ways in which community-based organizations train themselves up to meet their own immigration legal needs for so long, as immigration legal services kind of lagged behind the development of other types of civil legal aid in our state. And when I was practicing in New York and I was doing the networking thing, and the two people that did immigration in Vermont on my, our informational interviews told me, if you want to do immigration in Vermont, you're going to need to create your own job, because that doesn't exist here. And so I came anyway, doing general poverty law practice at Vermont Legal Aid, which I think was good for me to learn something new. but then I was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time when a position became available at the law school to join the teaching clinic. And really it's a collective effort with my longtime collaborator, Erin Jacobson, who was directing the clinic when she recruited me. And now she's just signed on to be VAF's advocacy director. So we're working together again. Michelle Janess at AALB, Don Siebert at the Prisoners' Rights Office. I understand Liz Schlegel's brother was also an immigration defense attorney like ages ago. And so that's a history I haven't documented well yet. But it's just like these few outstanding actors who just, they just feel it, and they've been holding it down with no resources and no support, no institutionalized, like no infrastructure to make that work sustainable. And so I kind of decided that this would be my big project. I was gonna, I knew I wanted to live in Vermont. It's a good place to be gay, and this is a place where it should be good to be a non-citizen, but for the lack of structural access because of the lack of attorneys. And I thought, okay, I could do a bunch, however many cases that I can in my career, or I could try and leverage my position to help create the infrastructure that I benefited from when I was a young lawyer. And so that's how we got started at VAP.
Let me ask, sort of winding up our conversation here, fear has really been the dominant emotion that so many people are feeling at this time with the immigration crackdown, whether it's fear of physical bodily harm from, the killings that we see by ICE agents in Maine and elsewhere. What is your message to immigrants right now who are just struggling to feel safe?
Feel emotional hearing that question. My message to immigrants in our community, my first and lasting message is just how sorry I am. I'm just so sorry. I'm sorry that this isn't what we promised. And there is no right or wrong way to respond or react to what is happening. You do not owe anyone telling your story or filing a case in court or fighting your case. You, and if you want to fight it, even if it's not that strong legally, that's your right too. And we're here for you. And you, whatever you want and need, we're here to help you clarify those things for yourself, reach as many of your goals as you can in the circumstances, and then, and hopefully in a new period of reconstruction for this country, think about what rebuilding and what reparation looks like. I'm just so sorry that this is happening. And the other thing I want people to know is that for every terrifying story about ICE hurting people, killing people in the streets, the stories about unfair things happening in courts of law, there are also stories of hope, of the system working as it should, of things going well that doesn't make the news, that lawyers like me are just too strung out and spread out to do a good job of telling everyone about. Just your questions about where, how VAP stood up has made me think. So one of our big achievements this year was to help seed a Vermont Legal Aid's first ever immigration legal practice. There is an attorney in the Poverty Law Project serving central Vermont and another attorney serving southern. And we're almost all the way to our goal of fundraising to sustain the pilot through calendar year 27. So we've got a foothold. We're feeling optimistic. And the other day, I went to one of the attorneys' supervision with a VAP staff just to observe. And they were speaking immigration law. They were issue spotting like a pro. They were triaging their docket. It was just so amazing to watch. And they asked me about a potential client that they had been, that had come through our intake. And they said the person's name. And this is a person who I had done their asylum case years ago in the before times, before that we had to drive to Boston three different times to get through the asylum merits hearing for this person. So many hours we spent late nights working on testimony, gathering evidence, like preparing witnesses, all the things, like the relationship you build with an asylum seeker client, it's very intimate. And now this person has come back to us for help with their green card, their lawful permanent residence. And one of the new Vermont Legal Aid community immigration lawyers is going to be the one to serve them. And so you think about, for me, that gives me hope, you know, like, wow, look what we did. Look at this thing we did. And the system in mundane routine ways, like what we do is in other administrations can be pretty boring. Like we're paper pushers. We're doing a lot of paperwork as immigration lawyers. And I want everyone to know that there is still paperwork, just papering and work permits being issued and green cards. Like there is good stuff still happening. This is a terrible, terrible moment, and it will pass.
Well, Jill Martin Diaz, I want to thank you for joining us again on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jill Martin Diaz is an immigration attorney and the executive director of the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.